This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, May 29th, 2019. I'm Caleb Brown. The high cost of college and the debt that students take on in order to pay for it may yet prove to be an important election issue. Cato's Diego Zuluaga has taken a look at two plans aimed at reducing college costs offered by presidential candidates and U.S. Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders.
When you take out higher education, typically you do it as an investment to gain skills that will increase your future income and will enable you to have access to jobs that otherwise you wouldn't, which are more remunerative in general than non-college degree requiring jobs. And in fact, if you look at the income premium, that is the extra income that you earn when you have a college degree, that's stayed pretty constant or even increased in the last 25, 30 years. So for a lot of people, I think it still makes sense to obtain higher education. The question is, do they have the information and the market signals to make the right decision when it comes to deciding which degree to take, how much money to borrow for their degree, and how long to stay in higher education? And I think that's where the signals get confused, mostly because of government intervention. A lot of Americans aren't aware of the fact that more than 90% of outstanding student loan burdens are related to the federal government. And so it's basically a government-run program of financial aid. And therefore, it shouldn't come as a surprise that it's been since that takeover in 2008, 2009, that most of the outstanding loan liabilities have accrued. So about half of the $1.5 trillion outstanding in student loans has been accrued since 2009. This is not a long-standing problem, as is often described, but rather it's something that has been driven both by the government takeover, as well as by the recession, which drove a lot of people back into education to gain additional skills to make themselves more useful in the job market. But also the fact that since then, we have increased the possibilities for people to reduce the amount of money that they repay. And that's created an incentive to borrow more money.
All right. So you mentioned young people, students not receiving the right signals, and you attribute some of that to broad federal intervention in the student loan market. I mean, it's almost unfair to say it's a federal intervention. It's almost a federal system. But to the extent that there are signals that private borrowers could provide, what would that look like if a private borrower were to say, well, we're going to give you this much for this degree or this much for this degree? Is that something private borrowers would be amenable to?
The best way to look at it is by comparing it to other lending markets in which private market forces and competition play more of a role. So normally when you borrow money to buy a house or you borrow money to buy a car, you go through a process known as underwriting, where the lender looks at your income, looks at what you're buying, looks at your record of repaying debts, looks at your credit score, which is a summary of your credit history over time. And on that basis, makes a decision, first of all, as to whether or not to lend you the money that you're asking for, or more or less, but also what interest rate to charge. And if you look at interest rates for car loans today, they vary tremendously with the credit score of the borrower. Not surprisingly, because the likelihood of default and conversely, the likelihood of repayment depend very much on the borrower's ability to repay and their history of repayment. So you will have, for people with relatively high credit scores, say 750 to 780, you will have something like a 3 to 5% interest rate on a car loan today. Whereas if you go down the credit score spectrum to the 620, 640s, it's much more like 10, 12, 14%. We don't find that with student loans. With student loans, interest rates are regulated and set every year by the Department of Education, and they range anywhere between 5 and 7%, but they don't change on the basis of the borrower's history or the degree that they're taking, which obviously has a lot of implications for the income that they will make, and how much debt they already have outstanding. In fact, the interest rate is, as I say, government set and government enforced, and it's dependent on government decision-making unrelated to the underlying risk. Now, what that causes is two things. First of all, taxpayers who ultimately are underwriting this program of student loans don't have, are not are not protected from exposure to student loan defaults to the extent that they would in a private market, because there's not that risk adjustment that you have in other segments of lending. But then secondly, the borrowers themselves have a hard time getting the right signals from the market as to whether it's a good idea to borrow or not, because even the risky people are subject to the lower interest rates. So the signal to them is to say, go ahead and borrow as much as you can. And then those people might find themselves in financial distress.
So with respect specifically to a couple of plans that have been unveiled to address, and sometimes not directly address, but address the problem of the large amount of borrowing that young people feel compelled to do, what is Elizabeth Warren's plan broadly? She seems to want to fund her plans through a increase in taxes for wealthy American families. So what is she proposing?
She's proposed a wealth tax, and I'm not privy to the specifics of the wealth tax plan, although I understand that it's been promised for several different programs. So I wonder if there's some element of double counting there. But as far as student loans go, Elizabeth Warren wants to forgive up to $50,000 for households or individuals with less than $100,000 in annual income. And what that amounts to is, out of the $1.5 trillion of outstanding loans, about half or slightly less than half, around $650 billion, would be forgiven under this program. Now, that may sound very good, and it may even sound equitable to some people, because you have the income threshold and you also have the maximum loan amount that's forgiven. But in fact, if what you're worried about is financial distress as a result of student borrowing, it's an entirely miscalibrated program. And that is because most financial distress, that is, most defaults, most people struggling to repay, are not struggling to repay because they owe a lot of money, but rather they're struggling to repay because they earn too little income. They're typically people who went to a two-year college or a career college and had to drop out of school because, you know, their family situation required them to go back to work. They're older, they have children, they have dependents. And as a result, they couldn't complete their degree, and they're not earning that income premium that I was talking about as a result of the degree. The people going to nonprofit four-year and, you know, private four-year colleges with much higher outstanding loan amounts, their default rates are much, much lower. And they're actually making much higher incomes to pay off that investment that they made in themselves. It's not the law school graduates and the med school graduates who are struggling. It's people at the lower end of the income spectrum. So we would be spending a lot of money, a lot of taxpayers' money, on rescuing people that don't need rescuing. This is quite a regressive program, meaning higher income people are more helped than lower income people. It's just a bad idea, bad fiscal policy.
So, yeah, I was wondering why someone who earns $100,000 a year up to $250,000 a year would need, or why those people ought to have any portion of their debts, their student debts, forgiven at all.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think the criterion for, you know, I think we should look at what's already there, because, and we can talk about this in a moment, there are already programs to address repayment to the income that you make to make sure that the burden doesn't become too much. And, you know, we can debate as to how well those programs are working. But I think for any forgiveness program, we should look at whether it's necessary. But the second question is to say, let's just target taxpayer liabilities to the people who are genuinely in distress, and where society's help might be justifiable. And as you say, the people with, you know, six-figure incomes, particularly the ones that have no problem repaying their student loans and are earning very well above the U.S. median household income, which is around 50-something, 60-something thousand, why they should be helped. So we can target the help much more effectively and lower the taxpayer liability as a result.
So with respect to the Bernie Sanders plan, he would like to make a vast range of education tuition free. From his own website, it's a pretty sparse description of it. Make public colleges, universities, and trade schools tuition free. Fully fund historically Black colleges and universities. Substantially lower student debt. Significantly lower interest rates on student loans. So, to the extent that the federal government is running broadly the student loan business in the United States, what would the effective impact of significantly lowering interest rates on student loans be? You've already sort of mentioned it.
Well, it encourages people to take longer to repay, which is usually not a good idea because this is valuable capital that could be redeployed elsewhere. It also distorts decision making because, as I explained, people don't get the right information about what the cost of their investment actually is. Then you have taxpayer subsidies, of course, involved because that's the only way you can pay for these lower rates. People think that somehow because the US government can borrow at 2 or 2.5% right now, that therefore they can also deploy that money for things like student loans at that same cost of capital. It's not the case at all because the credit risk involved in lending to the US government is lower than that involved in lending to people like, you know, young millennials like me with very few assets and only the promise of repayment. So you have to adjust for that in some sort of way, and taxpayers are exposed if you use the same interest rate. As far as public tuition goes, it becomes an industrial policy. It's redirecting students to public colleges from private ones and non-profit ones. It also creates incentives to take out more degrees, spend more time in higher education than perhaps you might want to do. In my native country of Spain, we have broadly free higher education, and that combined with a very dysfunctional labor market means that a lot of people stay on in higher education much longer than they would need to obtain valuable skills for the job market. And I don't think that that's the right way to go about things. So some of the same problems as with the Warren proposal apply in this case. And again, we think that higher education should be encouraged because there are some sort of social benefits that are gained from it, you know, more civic behavior, more informed citizenry. That's at least what we're told. However, the bulk of the gains from higher education accrue to the person obtaining it. And therefore, they should be responsible for the bulk of the cost of providing it. And anything that diverges from that is very likely to be regressive. One of the reasons, Caleb, I think people get so confused about the student loan issue is that DC, which is where a lot of these conversations are had, is very, very highly unrepresentative of the job market and the educational composition of the population of the rest of the country. More than 50% of DC residents have a bachelor's degree or higher. A lot of them have, you know, further graduate degrees, and some of them don't pay very well because, you know, they're public service related. You know, people do it as a vocation rather than necessarily for the income. That's not the case of the second most educated, as far as educational accreditation goes. The second most educated state, which is Massachusetts, is only about 43% bachelor's or higher. Now, what that means is that people assume that a much higher share of the American population goes to four-year colleges than they actually do. And so they misdiagnose the problem entirely, and they focus on people like themselves with relatively high student loan burdens, but also a high likelihood of increasing their earnings over time, rather than on the genuinely financially distressed people who live far away from Washington, D.C.
It seems to me that if you are going to make public colleges, universities, and even trade schools tuition-free and also significantly lower interest rates on student loans, that you're encouraging young people to think about higher education as more of a consumer good and less as an investment.
That's right. And I think some of particularly four-year higher education is already a consumer good. A lot of people major in things that they're interested in and that they like rather than in things they think are going to be particularly useful as far as income goes in their professional careers. And indeed, they may expect to learn on the job rather than learn at college what it is that they will need in order to be financially secure in the future. But a lot of other people, particularly people at the lower end of the income spectrum, people who pursue two-year degrees, who go to community colleges and career colleges, they are looking for skills-based training and things that will actually be useful in terms of giving them more choice and greater access to better paying options in the job market. And those people are not the bulk of the beneficiaries from these kinds of proposals. So it's mixing signals further. It's making education, potentially making education less relevant for the job market, which is quite concerning because that was the origin of a lot of the 20th century's programs for the expansion of higher education. And then it's it's fiscally irresponsible because we, you know, $1.5 trillion is less than 10% of U.S. GDP, but it's still $1.5 trillion of a federally guaranteed program that is increasingly divorced from the original goals, which were to increase the productivity of the economy and increase output and so on. At least that's what the promise was.
There is a popular plan that that young people take advantage of, the idea that if you work for the government or a nonprofit for 10 years after you get out of school, that at the end of those 10 years, after you make minimal payments, and I don't mean to diminish them, sometimes they are quite significant, that all the debt will be forgiven at the end of that 10-year period. And yet there are a lot of young people who have had trouble getting the feds to make good on that promise.
That's right. It's. I mean, I think the way to look at it is the current repayment, the current gamut of repayment programs offered by the Department of Education and federal student aid is a mire. There are 8 different repayment programs in addition to the one you mentioned, which is a special one called the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. And that makes it very difficult for borrowers, a lot of whom have relatively little financial literacy, not much experience dealing with financial issues on their own, to navigate and to apply for the programs that might be best suited for themselves. In addition to that, it's not clear that the programs are very well targeted, because public service loan forgiveness sounds very good, but oftentimes you're not talking necessarily about people who are making incomes well below what they could fetch on the open market. Rather, they work for nonprofits, or they work for the government, or they work for agencies, but they're earning competitive salaries. So they may be getting forgiveness, whereas someone in their same position would not get the same kind of treatment in the private sector. And to the extent that that is the case, you are, of course, encouraging people to move to certain kinds of employment activities, which may be good for themselves or not, but that's not the job of the government to do, to direct people financially as to where they should go to work. So the Trump administration has proposed to eliminate that public service loan forgiveness program, to integrate all the various what are called income-based repayment plans, that is, repayment plans that tie how much you pay every month to your income. And they're intended for people who have high loan burdens relative to the income that they currently make. So the administration has proposed to integrate those. And finally, they've proposed to cap the part of the student loan system that still remains without a cap, which is called the PLUS Loan Program. And just to give brief detail on it, this is a program aimed at parents and grad students. And basically, borrowers can either use the credit record of their parents, or when they have been accepted, admitted into a graduate program, they can borrow from this. And there's no limit up to the full cost of tuition as to how much they can borrow. Of course, the consequence of that, as in other markets where supply is constricted, has been that, you know, the more money has been made available, the greater the increase in tuition has been. And a Federal Reserve Bank of New York paper that was published a couple of years ago found that for every dollar of additional student aid, tuition went up by 60 cents. And that's an effect that's pervasive whenever government gives subsidies to products that are not difficult to increase, where the supply is not elastic, as we would say in economics, right? Where it's difficult to increase the amount that you provide. Prices just go up because demand is bid up. And that's precisely what's happened here. So it's not just on the borrowing end and the, if you will, the retail, the front end, where we have problems in student loan policy in the United States, but it's also when it comes to repayment, we're making things overly complicated, fiscally potentially costly, and not efficient to the extent that resources are misallocated and prices are needlessly increased as a result of policy.
Diego Zuluaga is a policy analyst at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.